I'm Greg Johnson.
And I'm John Morgan.
Hey, I'm Frody.
Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. We are doing another roundtable today. And as usual, we begin by thanking our donors. We are trying to raise $100,000 this year, which is a bit ambitious. But it's really not all that ambitious compared to our goals, which is basically changing the direction of human history. If we're going to change the direction of human history, we can certainly aim to raise $100,000. So we've raised $51,074.23 so far. I don't know how that 23 cents got in there. Hope somebody donates 77 cents so we have a nice round figure at least. Anyway, since our last podcast, we've received $20 from BB, $50 from CW, $50 a month from DG, $50 from RS, $120 from HA, $30 a month from RR, $50 from DB, $20 from MP, $50 a month from SM, $10 from DC, $10 a month from OP, $2,768 from JA, which is really wonderful. Thank you very much. $500 from TP, again, a very generous donation. $5.23 from R. That came to our P.O. box, and he specifically wanted me to give a shout out to him so he knows that the money that he's sending to the P.O. box is getting there. Yeah, R, your $5.23 got there. Roger, I'll just say that name because there are lots of Rogers out there, right? Roger, your $5.23 got to us, so thank you very much. Randy, your $100 got to us as well. J&M, we received $200 from them. Thank you very much. N sent $100. 14 sent $35, and 14 sent $35 again. Thank you very much. We received $500 from JM. That's very generous. $400 from KM, also very generous. JS gave $125. PL gave $250. MM gave $10. We received $11 from DS, $20 from R, $10 from C, and 10 from M. So thank you very much. We are again at $51,074.23. And that is a huge step towards our goal. In fact, we're exactly 51.07423% of the way to our goal. So thank you again. One thing I should add is that we were deplatformed again. This is the second time this year we were deplatformed from credit card processing. We found a new solution to that. And it turns out that many of the monthly donations that people signed up for, we can simply get going again automatically. You won't have to re-sign up for those. Some of you will have to sign up again. And as soon as we sort all that out, it's kind of complicated, you're going to receive emails to that effect. So thank you very much to our monthly donors. We really appreciate you. There are more than 50 of you out there. You've been very patient, you've been very generous, and we're going to get this mess sorted out very soon.
Thanks, everybody. It's really quite heartening to see so many people willing to give up their money to support us. So thanks a lot.
So today, I want to talk about some more normie questions, basically. Last week's show, we answered a few questions from our readers, our viewers, our listeners. People sent in questions that they have gotten from family members, from friends, from normies of their acquaintance that they would like a little help in answering. And I think it's really fun just to have argument and talking point clinics. So we're going to do this again. We're going to call it Ask Countercurrents, and we're going to make this a regular feature of our podcast. We might have one or two a month where we just do this roundtable format with your questions. And the first and most basic question that somebody sent in is the so-called RQ, the restaurant question. And for years, we've been noticing that practically the last refuge of multiculturalism is to appeal to a vast quantity of diverse ethnic restaurants. What a boon that multiculturalism brings to our societies. And I've always found that to be amusing. I sort of smile when I hear the restaurant line because I know that they're on their last legs. They're on the ropes. We just need to finish them off. So what are some good arguments for finishing people off when they finally retreat to the restaurant issue? Frody, do you want to start?
Yeah, and I first of all, I want to start by saying that I think it's quite fun that people also responded to our previous podcast from last week in comments and so on. They responded to, you know, what we said and so on. And I think it's fun to have a discussion. And maybe we can sort of bring up some of the comments and we can talk a bit about them as well.
Sure. Sure.
The restaurant question, the food question, I mean, like you often say, Greg, it doesn't pass the laugh test. It's laughable to begin with, and you want to destroy an entire nation just to have more ethnic restaurants. And of course, the fact is that you can import all kinds of recipes without importing the chef.
Right, exactly. Right? You can import the recipes, you can import the spices. You can cook your own damn Thai food. In fact, I cook really good Thai food. I cook really good Indian food. So we don't need to import the chefs. And we certainly don't need to import their whole families and their whole villages.
Yeah. And the funny thing is that, you know, when you go to an average pizzeria in Sweden, they aren't really Italians. it isn't Italian chefs that we have imported to get those pizza shops going. It's more like, you know, Arabs. It's Middle Easterners. So apparently they were able to sort of make these pizzas without importing the Italians. So it doesn't really make sense that way either.
Right.
Well, in Sweden, don't they have this type of pizza? It's called like kebab pizza or something like that. I tried some when I was in Sweden once, and it was actually pretty good. But yes, there were definitely no Italians in the establishment working there.
Yeah, exactly.
So we don't import French people to work in our French restaurants or Italians to work in our Italian restaurants. So why do we import Mexicans to work in our Mexican restaurants? And if you look in the kitchens in America of any restaurant, they're all Mexican restaurants. If you judge by the kitchen staff, the people who are cleaning up in the back. The other thing that I like to say is that, fine, we'll give you your vast diversity of restaurants. You give us complete immigration restriction on every other category of worker, and we'll give you your fine diversity of restaurants. And that would basically reduce non-white immigration into any white country by 99.something%. Because almost none of these people come to open restaurants. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, we could just concede the restaurant thing if they would concede us the rest of immigration. But obviously they don't want to do that. But it would basically reduce immigration to almost nothing if we just imported restaurant workers. Just imported chefs. Let's just import chefs. Skilled chefs.
I should mention a guy who is currently considered the greatest sushi chef in the U.S. His name is David Bohadana. I've actually been to, he has a pair of restaurants in New York right now called Sushi by Bo. It was extremely good. And he is of French and Lebanese descent. He's not Japanese at all. Mm-hmm. But he went there and learned how to do it from the masters and came back and mm-hmm. open restaurants in New York. So there you have it. The best sushi in New York City is from a non-Japanese person.
Well, for years.
Half white, non-Japanese person.
For many, many years, the best Chinese restaurant on the West Coast was owned by a white guy.
Yes.
So that's, it's possible. And he went to China and learned how to cook. Came back and opened a restaurant.
And also on a more serious note, though, with regard to food and immigration, there's another thing we import when we import people who have different cultures with regard to food than we do, and that is we import a way of butchering animals that would not really jive with our sensibilities and our compassion for animals, because these halal butcheries and kosher butcheries and whatever are not really, you know, in line with our standards of how to treat animals. And maybe some of our listeners have seen some of these horrible images of how they're butchered in those types of shops, which really has no place in Europe.
Yeah, and I think one of the best wedge issues that Europeans can use against immigration from Muslims is to shut down halal butchers. Mm-hmm. It just makes it more difficult for them to live in European countries if they can't have properly tortured meat.
Mm-hmm.
Properly tortured, yes.
Yeah. Are there any other thoughts on the restaurant question?
I think it's pretty straightforward. I think we've covered it.
Yeah, I think the element of it that I love the best is how arrogant and detached and upper middle class and bougie, you know, the whole thing is. It's sort of like it's like, let them eat burritos. Mm-hmm. You know, it's so arrogant. The very idea that we can dismiss the catastrophic consequences in terms of crime and alienation and ethnic cleansing, white flight, whatever, caused by mass third world immigration into white countries, that we can basically ignore all that because we think that we're going to get some really, really authentic burritos out of it. The kind of people who think that's a good deal are really out of touch and really kind of immoral. It is sort of like a Marie Antoinette let them eat burritos moment, mm-hmm. when they actually say stuff like that. And I think we should make fun of them. Fukuyama's book, Identity, which is one of the weakest defenses of multiculturalism I've ever encountered, uses the restaurant argument. It's hilarious. He talks about how multiculturalism was so good to Washington, D.C. Before multiculturalism, Washington, D.C. was a boring town that was basically biracial with blacks and white people. And the most exotic restaurant was something called the Kowloon Palace or whatever, some Chinese place. So I guess there's some Chinamen there too cooking. And now you can go to these vibrant neighborhoods and you can eat Ethiopian and Laotian and all this other food. And of course, he doesn't dwell at all upon the yuppie ethnic cleansing that took place to create this restaurant utopia that he's extolling here. What happened in Washington, D.C. is there were race riots and things like that. Large numbers of whites moved out of the city. Then, through quote-unquote gentrification, some kinds of whites started moving back into the city. And then all these non-whites, these third world immigrants, started moving into the city as well. We're just going to ignore the history of ethnic cleansing that took place to create this restaurant utopia. And I think that's really kind of arrogant and out of touch with basic morality, frankly. Mm-hmm. But that's the restaurant argument in a nutshell. Let's ignore the rapes. Let's ignore the infectious diseases. Let's ignore the ethnic cleansing. Let's ignore the unsafe subways and public transportation. Let's ignore all of that. Let's ignore the clitoridectomies and the honor killings and the acid attacks and the knife attacks and just dwell on shawarma, the glories of slop like that that you can buy in cheap food places.
Mm-hmm. But it reminds me of something you said, Frody, once in another podcast of yours I listened to, where you, it was a slightly different argument, but a corollary to this, where people who say, well, you know, I understand the point you're making, but, you know, I have this one non-white friend who I really like, and I really think it would be unfair, you know, to have mm-hmm. to send him out of the country. And your response was, well, this isn't about you.
Yeah.
This is about principles. It's about culture. And I think it's the same here.
It's not about your stomach.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's not about what one person enjoys. It's not, you know, I happen to prefer to hang out with this one person. Politics is about how large groups of people work together, how they function in a society. And the fact is that we see a breakdown of society in multiracial societies. And like you said, Greg, but people who are wealthy and don't live in the slums, they don't see that, and they can just see some of the aesthetic fineries and, you know, just some of the details. They can focus in on that and just ignore what the majority of the people suffer through.
Exactly. They're condescending, they're LARPing, they're going from their safe, mostly white suburban enclaves or urban enclaves into the diverse areas to try this great new Laotian restaurant or something like that. They're about as out of touch as Marie Antoinette pretending she's a milkmaid in the gardens of Versailles. Mm-hmm. It's a kind of LARPing. It's a kind of condescension. It's extremely out of touch with reality. And it's the reason why populism is on the rise and why people are really just starting to hate and despise and distrust our elites. They're vicious, out-of-touch people. So there's a couple questions that a friend of ours sent in. And I just want to read a few of these because they were really quite good. She gives us the following, quote-unquote, well-intentioned text from an immediate family member. Quote, "There are so many worthwhile causes in the world. Why waste your life affiliated with a hate group? Please go to the library and read some unbiased books on any of this." I think that's really kind of rich. And I guess the question is really the hate question. Is white identity politics hate? And if it is hate, does that disqualify it? You know, we must always listen to the voice of Obi-Wan Kenobi in our head saying, "Don't give in to hate, Luke. That leads to the dark side." Our culture is saturated with these stupid platitudes that somehow hate is intrinsically wicked and evil. And people really capitalize on that attitude. I like to say to people who talk about hate, well, wait a second here. Is it the good kind of hate or is it the bad kind of hate? Just to get people thinking, are there circumstances in which hate is appropriate? If people are behaving in a hateful way to you, isn't it appropriate and indeed inevitable that you're going to feel hateful back?
Well, I would say it's more about loving our own people and our own culture, our own civilization. But when it's constantly stuck in your face that you're supposed to feel bad about that, and that, you know, your own people are bad, and that having these kinds of positive feelings for your own culture and your own people, which is essentially your own family, of course you're going to feel hate when people are just constantly bombarding you with these messages. And when you meet people who don't respect your customs and don't respect your ways, and in fact are contemptuous of them, as is the case with many non-whites in our countries, you're naturally going to feel hate. So the way for us to start going back to the power of love again is to separate.
Right.
Because, as they say, absence makes the heart grow fonder.
Yeah, yeah. I think once, familiarity breeds contempt.
Once all the Arabs and Africans are back in their own countries, then maybe we can develop a greater appreciation. You know, we can go on holidays there. Mm-hmm. And we can appreciate it and then think, you know, but I'm very glad that I have my own culture to go back to where
exactly.
I can feel comfortable and don't have to worry about the things I encounter here happening to me.
Yeah, exactly. I agree. The primary emotion in any kind of identitarian or nationalist political movement is love of one's own. And if you don't have love of one's own, then you're not an identitarian. You're not a nationalist. You're not even a human being. You're not a normal human being if you don't have a certain natural warmth and preference and sentimental attachment for things that are your own, including your own family, your own tribe, your own nation, your own race, etc. So that's the primary feeling. And if we were on an island all by ourselves, just sort of basking in love of our own, would we hate anybody?
Probably not. We'd probably find other people's fascinating.
We'd find them fascinating. We'd find them interesting and exotic. I'm not such a cynic that I think that if we were left on our own little island, let's say that there was a planet where there was only one intelligent race. Let's just say that whites were the only race on the planet. Would we be so inclined to find enemies that we'd start hating one another over minor differences? Some people will make cynical claims like that, and it might be true, but it would not be racial differences. Yeah. It'd be ethnic differences, religious differences. God knows Europeans have fought for thousands of years with one another over minor differences.
It would be like that episode of the original Star Trek with the guys who are black on one side and white on the other.
Yeah.
And they hate the ones where, you know, it's reversed.
Yeah, yeah. Because it's all so arbitrary. Yeah, what a woke TV series Star Trek was. But I think that whatever the tendency of human beings to divide themselves up and squabble, if you live in a monoracial society, at least there's going to be no race hatred involved. And that's really what we stand for. We want a society without race hatred, and that really means a society where each race has its own homeland, or many homelands, because there are many different peoples, distinct peoples within the different races. So I think the primary motive and the primary emotion is the love of one's own. Race hatred is something that is artificial generally, because if you just allow people to associate with one another freely, they will tend to separate and build barriers between them, which is why multiculturalism is unnatural and it has to be forced constantly.
George Lincoln Rockwell, there's a quote by him where he says that love is just an empty word if you don't hate that which seeks to harm what you love.
Right.
And I do think that many people get involved in this because they are worried about what will happen to future generations, simply because we have on record what happens when white people become minorities among other races. We have that in, you know, the revolution in San Domingo,
right?
We have South Africa. We have many areas in Europe currently where white people are dispossessed. And other races are not as pathologically altruistic as white people are. So when they become the majority and when they hold the power, they will not be as generous as we have been.
Right.
So I think many people are rationally concerned about what will happen to their children and children's children when they become an ethnic minority. So, yeah, hatred for the people who implement that future will be natural and healthy.
Right.
Definitely. So I do think that hate is a part of it. But, of course, it is only hate because you are concerned about the people you love.
Right.
You're not arbitrarily hating.
Yeah.
And especially you're not really hating other races. I have a hatred for the elites who are forcing this upon us.
Right.
I do hate them. But I do think that there are many layers to this question. Of course, the initial layer is the silliness of assuming that the only reason you're involved in that nationalism is because you want to virtue signal. There are many other causes where you can virtue signal without being attacked, as if that is the main cause for why you get involved. You know, you can save the tigers or something that's not controversial and feel good about yourself. And that, of course, reveals something that is quite ugly about human nature in sort of the in the majority, really, because many people will want to virtue signal, but only if it doesn't really cost them anything.
Right.
It's like there's one quote which I can't remember by Rousseau in his book Emile, where he talks about, you know, you should beware of those philosophers who want to basically help people on the other side of the planet, but are not as generous to their own neighbors. Basically, they want a virtue signal in a situation where they don't really have any consequences for it, but in their own private lives, they are kind of cynical and not as sort of open-hearted as they sort of pretend to be by donating this or that amount to people on the other side of the planet, and they want to save the rainforests, and they want to save black people in Africa, and they want to import them, but just into other people's homes, of course,
right,
not into their own home. And I think that this question just reveals something nasty about people, that, well, the only reason you could be involved in this more, this political movement, is to virtue signal, so other people would pat you on the back. Well, whereas in reality, if you actually want to fight for things that are really important, that might actually come at a cost, at a social cost, instead of a social gain, you know, because people lose their jobs by being involved in this. And then it's because, or more, over their lives, they get attacked physically and lose everything. So I do think that it's like we are not really motivated by such petty motives.
Well, also, right. Haven't there been cognitive studies which show that an individual human is only capable of genuinely showing affection for or having empathy for, I think it's about 300 people maximum. I believe there have been studies which
probably
show this.
Even less than that.
So if you have this affection for other people on the other side of the planet, it has nothing to do with the actual reality of them. Mm. It just has to do with your idea of them. And
your idea of yourself as a good person, and you can pat yourself on the back.
Right. Well, on the first immediate level, it's just cheap emotional manipulation to try and label your enemies haters, as if everybody doesn't hate somebody. Everybody hates somebody. And
the Antifa people and the left really definitely hate us.
Yeah,
I mean, you don't see, if we take America as an example, because probably most of our listeners are in America, you don't really see the right, support claims of or suggestions of punching a leftist. But you definitely see, you know, politically correct people thinking it's or giving their approval to, quote unquote, punching a Nazi.
Yeah. Right,
where Nazi is just anyone you disagree with politically who is sort of against globalization.
Right. Yeah, any white person opposed to globalization is a Nazi now. So the basic level of it is so childish. You're a hater. You believe that there's an us and a them, unlike liberals. But we don't have any enemies.
We
right?
don't have that. We don't think in us terms.
Yeah, we don't think in us and them terms, unlike you, evil haters. Yeah, exactly.
They're so stupid, silly.
They really are laughable. But yeah, so there's this pretense that there's these holy, saintly, hate-free people on the left. Yeah, right. The people who gave us communism, the people who gave us Antifa. These people are saintly, hate-free people, and they look down upon our hateful shenanigans. Give us a break. It's a fake, emotionally manipulative image of reality that they're trying to paint from the very beginning, and we don't accept that. So we say phooey on that. Everybody hates somebody. The question is it reasonable? That's the reasonable question. The other question is that the primary thing? I think that's important. It's not the primary thing. It's not really about hate. And I think that's how we need to answer it. It's not really about hate. Hate might creep into it because politics is about us and them. And when politics gets really polarized, yeah, hate is one of those emotions, but that's universal.
Healthy people hate those who want to harm the people they love.
Exactly. But that's not the primary thing. So first of all, it's emotional manipulation and pretense. Second, I would say it's not the primary thing. Third, I think we can then introduce a discussion of whether hate can be reasonable and justified in certain circumstances. Once they climb down off their high horse, or once we knock them off their high horse, if they're going to actually be willing to have a discussion of this issue, we can actually parse out whether there are circumstances in which it's reasonable or not reasonable to feel hateful feelings. So yeah, I think there are levels to this debate that we can engage in, but maybe the first and most basic response is just to say, yeah, right, and you don't hate anybody, you're just all full of love, right?
It's just a stupid case of screaming out in pain as they strike you, because we are the only political category that is hated and persecuted out of our workplace, mm-hmm. persecuted in you know, schools and education and everywhere, and prevented from participating in the political process on the same terms as everyone else. So we are the ones who are really hated and persecuted in this. And that's the silly thing of calling us the aggressors. It's like when the EU, or rather Poland, banned Jared Taylor from entering into Europe because they claimed that he was totalitarian. So, I mean, if he were totalitarian, he wouldn't have any power to implement that. So the actual totalitarian power who implemented totalitarianism against him called the victim totalitarian, which is, you know, a case of...
I think the Poles would be a little more self-conscious, because aren't they the ones who came up with that saying about crying out in pain as somebody strikes you? I think that's where it comes from.
I think it's a Polish thing, yeah.
Yeah. Another question that we've been asked by the same person, actually, is why do you use the term white nationalist? People will say we shouldn't use that term because they'll put their fingers in their ears right away from social conditioning. They'll equate it with white supremacy, with Hitler, with El Paso, with New Zealand. So it doesn't work. And so we shouldn't use that term. So why do we use the term white nationalist? Well, my answer to that is kind of nuanced, as you probably would expect. People are used to that from us, I guess. Nuance. It's our strength. But anyway, why do I use the term white nationalist? Well, first of all, even if I thought it was a bad term, it's too late now. I've written the White Nationalist Manifesto. I'm sort of stuck with it. I'm going to be the author of the White Nationalist Manifesto for the rest of my life and on into literary posterity. And I'm just going to have to stick with it. That's my first answer. The reason why I use the term is because I think it's descriptive. I think it's a defensible, descriptive term for what I stand for. White nationalism, as I define it, means advocating the right of self-determination for all white peoples. A right doesn't mean an obligation. It means something that they can choose to exercise or not if they think that their identity is being threatened by multicultural systems, multicultural polities, and they want out. I think it's a defensible term. The fact that it is being smeared and attacked in the media is actually, in some ways, a compliment, in some ways, a good thing. If they were ignoring us, they wouldn't demonize us. And any term can be demonized. We could be rainbow unicorn nationalists, and they'd still attack it. They'd still try and attach negative connotations to it. And some kook with a rainbow unicorn on his rifle will show up and shoot up a mosque someday. And we'd have to deal with that. And so if we change our brand, if we change our name, and we're actually a threat to the powers that be, they're going to stigmatize us anyway. And given that the term isn't inherently a bad term, it's not like, you know, we're talking about... I mean, it would be really bad optics if we had, like, kill such and such nationalism, right? You know, that would be really bad optics. But white nationalism is a completely...
Anti-POC nationalism.
Yeah, kill POC nationalism. Bad optics, that. I definitely would agree with that. Probably not a good term. White nationalism is not inherently... a violent, evil-sounding term. It's just a descriptive term. And yes, it's being attacked and it's being stigmatized, probably as a tribute to its effectiveness. It's a good idea. It's an idea whose time has come. It's an idea that threatens the establishment, so they want to attack it. I'm all for using other terms, though, in different contexts, if that makes sense. So I like people using dissident right. People can use alt-right, people can use white identity politics, national populism, whatever.
I think identitarianism is good, although the problem there is that people don't know if you're referring to the concept generally or specifically to the identitarian movement.
Right.
And while, you know, I'm not disparaging the movement, you know, obviously we have a broader... we're not just looking at them particularly when we say identitarian, we're referring to
right.
all of our people.
You can say small I identitarian or something like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are all useful terms. I don't dispute using those. I use those terms myself in various contexts. I think that's something that you need to do to gauge your audience and speak in terms that are going to be less triggering. But ultimately, I'm going to plant my flag with white nationalism.
There is a funny thing. I recognize that I always go back to Sweden and say, well, in Sweden, this happened. You know, but that's because Sweden is often used as a example of political correctness and stupidity just gone wild. It's interesting, you know, the things that happen there. And I also, of course, because I have vast experience of what happens there. But an example of words sort of gaining a certain meaning and becoming a burden to whatever the word refers to is the gypsies. For some reason, people have not been fond of gypsies throughout history. So what they attempted is to sort of, it's not polite to call them gypsies anymore. We'll have to call them Roma people.
Yes, I've gotten this.
So the thing is that you're not supposed to say gypsy because that's a bit of a bad word. It's a bit of a negative sort of connotation to it.
Right.
I don't know if that's because of the sort of what the word refers to, but anyhow, so you have to use Roma. But then again, that also, for some mysterious reason, also gained this negative connotation because people don't like that either. And so they tried to move on to a second term in Sweden, which is EU migrants. So wherever you go in Sweden, you'll see outside of grocery stores, you'll see EU migrants, so-called.
Outside of train stations.
Outside of train stations with a sort of a paper cup begging for money and saying, hey, hey. And it's a bit of a joke because the thing is that it doesn't matter what you call them. People are going to have the same opinions about whatever it is, you know.
Right.
So, yeah. I mean, yeah, there is some sense to this sort of postmodern word magic that it's like word games and so on. But if there is an inherent quality to a specific thing that the word refers to, it doesn't really help to just change the wording. It helps for a very, very brief period of time when people are still confused about the meaning of the term. But then when they're aware, they're still going to, I don't want that many EU migrants outside of my grocery store where I go do my shopping.
Right, exactly. Well, it's the same for unjustly stigmatized terms. There's a justice to stigmatizing gypsies. They have sort of self-stigmatizing behavior patterns. There's nothing bad about the idea of ethnic nationalism and self-determination, but people who oppose it are going to try and make it sound bad and scary.
The thing is, though, that I like the term white nationalism because it actually refers to what I believe in. If you try to placate your enemies, the people who attack you and want to harm you, and you try to sort of run away from them a bit by using another term, well, then they'll attack that and you'll just never stop running away from
them. You'll never stop running,
yeah. It's never ending. So might as well just plant a flag and say, this is what we stand for. And I think white nationalism is an apt term. I mean, I'm first and foremost, my identity is Scandinavian. Mm-hmm. I identify with Scandinavia, with Scandinavian countries, with the Scandinavian heritage, the sort of religion, spirituality, the language, the culture, the history, the literature, etc. But I call myself a white nationalist because I recognize the fact that this Scandinavian identity is a part of a wider identity, which is white European, and we share the same destiny and fate with other white European people all over the world. If they live in Europe, the United States, in South Africa, in Australia, and so on, we're all attacked because we're white. Yeah. And we should therefore stand up together and defend our right to be who we are and defend our interests. And that's why I think it's the best term that can describe, that sort of describes what I stand for and what I represent.
Yeah.
Because I'm interested in the interests of all white people wherever they live, although I don't live everywhere. I happen to live in Scandinavia and be a part of that more specific, more narrow identity. But still, our fate is sort of interconnected with the fate of white people, generally speaking.
Yeah, I can agree with that. Another friend sent in this question. He says, the biggest one I come across, the biggest objection he comes across is that, practically speaking, white nationalism is going to involve violence and possibly even genocide, even if white nationalists don't want to use violence to achieve their goals. Basically, what happens to the non-whites who refuse to leave the areas demarcated as white homelands? Aren't we going to have to use a great deal of violence to achieve our aims? There are several levels to answering this question. First of all, the people who fed post online, they're constantly saying things to me, we're not going to vote our way out of this. You can just imagine them cradling their AR-15 as they type, we're not going to vote our way out of this into the internet. There are people who say that I'm naive and I think that violence is a bad thing that will not be required to achieve our goals, et cetera, et cetera. My response to that is that every white nationalist wants state power. We believe that we need control of the state and the state apparatus to achieve our goals. We want to have power and put laws on the books and policies on the books that will be good for our peoples, that will restore our homelands, that will halt immigration and begin emigration. Now, behind every law is the threat of force. So we're realistic about that to that extent. We believe that we need state power. We want to change the laws. We want to have law and order. We want to have responsibility, accountability, oversight, and all of the features that civilized societies have. But we want law and order, and ultimately that's backed up with the threat of force. So sue me, right? Everybody in politics wants to change the laws and institute policies that they think are better than the current ones and will back those up with the threat of force. That's what politics is all about. All politics involves violence on some level. The question is it lawless violence? Is it violence that doesn't respect the human rights and procedural rights of individuals? Or is it lawful violence that respects human rights, procedural rights, things like that? That's what I think we should stand for. We want to have a lawful transition to societies that put white interests first. And once we have political power and we can institute policies that will halt immigration and commence emigration, the ways that we can do that are manifold. And the thing that we have to do, though, is reassure people that this is not going to entail some vast explosion of state violence. First of all, most people who come to our countries, most non-white immigrants, come here because there are incentives in place and because it's easy to do so. If we prevent them from coming and actually give them incentives to leave, they'll pick up of their own accord and leave on their own. And I think that's a good thing to do. If there are non-whites in our society who are, say, over the age of 45 or 50, my attitude about people like that is like, what's the average lifespan? They're not going to be having children at that age. They're not a problem. There's a simple biological solution to that. We simply have to wait. Right? Aging populations die off. And as long as they're not being constantly replaced, then there's no demographic threat there. So my attitude is that we should first of all just say, if you're old, just continue with your life. Work your job, retire, grow old, die unmolested. And when you're gone, you're simply not going to be replaced by more people like you. What I would do with people who are younger populations who are of childbearing age is I would give them incentives to leave, pursue education overseas, reconnect with their families back in the Philippines or Mexico or wherever they come from, things like that. We don't have to do this fast either. We can wait 40 or 50 years. As long as we get the policies in the right order and stick with them, we can just wait. The trouble that we face today is not sudden, fast white genocide. It's slow demographic displacement. If we simply turn around the incentives and have slow demographic replenishment and slow ebbing of the rising tide of color out of our countries, we'll be just fine. Mm-hmm. Now, does that mean that there will be no circumstances under which the state will actually have to send people out to arrest somebody and drag them away and kick them out of the country? Of course there are going to be circumstances like that. If there are people who have come here and overstayed their visas, are abusing the system, who have come here illegally and so forth, and they're not self-deporting, eventually we will have to, you know, kick them out.
I mean,
there's nothing crazy, you know, insane or, you know, World War II genocidal about that. That's just law enforsement.
I think what you're saying, I mean, what you said first there, you know, the Fed posting bit, I think this is, you know, it's not constructive. It's not going to help us. That's that kind of stupid talk about violence and so on. There is a genocide going on right now against white people. Mm-hmm. And overall, it's, like you said, it's slow. But in some cases, it's hotter.
Yeah.
I mean, thousands of white women get raped every year and attacked, violently attacked, even killed, simply for, you know, because they're white, because that is a way of violently showing dominance, that other races are violently being dominant over us, the host population, attacking us. Even white kids are being attacked in schools. So there is violence involved
already.
There is violence. There's plenty of violence. I mean, I don't know the statistics by heart, but I assume there's a lot of, you know, many thousands of, you know, murders and so on committed by black people against white people, and so on in America, all over Europe. So there is violence going on.
Quite a bit of violence. And if we actually enforce the laws and protect people against that violence, that will also be violence, but there's a difference. There's a difference between the violence necessary to enforce the laws and protect the innocent and establish justice, and the violence of people who are criminals and delinquents.
The thing is that, exactly, every state has the right to use force against those who violently oppose it.
Yeah.
And that will also be the case when we have the state power, or when people with our vision and our dreams and our who want to carry on our destiny have that state power. Of course they will have the right to use force against those who violently oppose it and refuse to abide by its laws. But the question is, how do we get from here to get that state power? How do we go? How do we work as a political movement? Does that include violence? No, it doesn't.
Yeah,
it would
I think
be
it's
counterproductive.
Yeah.
All use of violence is completely counterproductive and should be, you know, shunned by everyone who's serious.
Yeah, I think that's really true. At this point, it's very clear that every violent act by some people, some person like Brenton Tarrant or this Crucius fellow in El Paso, is simply used as an excuse by the state to deplatform, censor, marginalize us further, and that ultimately costs white lives. These people think that they're striking a blow for the white man by shooting Mexicans shopping at Walmart in El Paso or Muslims praying in New Zealand. But every day, every hour that they delay the implementation of the kinds of policies that we are promoting, they're actually costing white lives. They're costing the lives of white people who will die because of diversity, and the lives of white people who will never be born because of diversity. And so we have to look at it that way. It's always easy for people to think in terms of what's right in front of them, but not think in terms of the costs. of what they're doing. And these high time preference, and I think very selfish, self-involved shooter types never think of the long-term consequences. They never think very clearly about what exactly they're going to accomplish. They think that somehow they're going to galvanize imitation and there'll be some kind of uprising and brief, glorious campaign of ethnic cleansing and everything will be fine. But they don't really think very clearly about how that's going to happen. And it doesn't happen, right? There are one or two imitators, but there's never going to be an insurrection.
They don't know how politics works. They don't know how power works in the current year, so to speak.
Yeah.
They don't understand how society works. They don't understand the dynamics of power. They don't understand that. This major change, this sort of shift of direction for the modern society will take completely other... We will need completely other methods to achieve that. And violence is just not a part of that because, you know, the it's not effective. So it's just stupid. It's counterproductive, and ultimately it's evil because it harms our cause. And those people should be rejected completely.
Yeah, we need to have zero tolerance for Fed posters on our platforms. We need to mock and deconstruct their arguments, their rationales that they put forward, and try and prevent people from getting sucked in by these people's arguments. And if somebody makes credible threats in front of you in your presence of doing something violent, I've come to the point where I believe it's better to talk to the police before a preventable tragedy than have them visit you after one and say, weren't you in a chat with so-and-so who just shot up the such-and-such community center?
Yes.
I would much rather talk to the police before such an event than after one. I think we really need to crack down on this kind of stuff because it is so counterproductive. And I do not buy the argument that we should have solidarity and sort of black attitudes about quote-unquote snitching and things like that. People who are objectively harming our movement are our enemies. They might not think they're Antifa, but they're Antifa. They might not think that they're globalists, but they're globalists. If they are objectively harming our movement by doing illegal stuff, we should be the first ones to drop the dime on them if they're doing it in our presence. And announcing that you have that policy is an insurance policy for us that people are not going to be talking about this kind of stuff in our presence. And that's an important thing. We can't completely insulate ourselves from all this craziness, but we can certainly try and deter people who are inclined towards these ideas from interacting with us.
Yeah, they can have their own weird movement somewhere.
Yeah, Iron March or wherever. Yeah. So any other thoughts on this?
No, I mean, there's no particular reason why this change has to be violent. But like you said, if we were able to attain state power, which we will eventually, yes, there might be a brief period where there's some unpleasantness. But the trade-off would be after that, it would virtually disappear.
Yeah, that's another thing we have to think about in terms of which ideology is inherently violent. Because a lot of people are trying to brand white nationalism as an inherently violent ideology. They say that the implementation of our politics will inherently require violence. Well, newsflash, every political program will be backed up by state force, and that entails the possibility of violence.
Well,
so that's just a wash.
It's hardly peaceful.
Yeah, yeah. So that's just a wash. Every political party is advocating violence implicitly on some level. The question is it necessary? Is it lawful? Is it humane, etc.? Is it the good kind or the bad kind? But the other thing is this. The idea that white nationalism is inherently violent is absurd because the whole point of white nationalism is to remove one of the primary causes of hatred and violence in our societies, which is multiculturalism. Multiculturalism is an inherently violent ideology. And when people try and pin this idea that we are advocates of an inherently violent ideology on us. We simply have to shoot back. Oh no, it's multiculturalism that's the inherently violent ideology. If they get their way, there will be more and more violence. If we get our way, there will be less violence. There will be less hatred in the world. We're not utopians. We're not unrealistic. We do recognize that bad things will continue to happen, but we believe that ethnic nationalism and separation will avoid a great deal of easily avoidable violence and hatred and unhappiness. That's what we stand for. They're the ones doubling down on the causes of violence. We're the ones advocating a solution to that. And therefore, if you try and balance it out, we'll put it this way. The multiculturalists who want to arrest people for Facebook posts in the UK, they're advocating violence. They're sending the police out. The police threaten violence. They're doing that to ensure conditions that will make more violence inevitable. Whereas if we had our way and we passed laws to halt immigration, commence repatriation, yes, there might be instances where people violate those laws and the police have to go out and haul them into court and they have to go to trial and et cetera. You know, they might pull a gun, they might get shot, whatever. We recognize that, but the long-term result of our policies being enforced is going to be less overall social violence. So I think that's the way we just have to look at it and defend it.
Yes.
So we've been going on for about an hour, and I think that this is another good podcast. We're really just knocking them out of the park, frankly. We're getting a lot of very positive feedback for these shows, and they have a really solid listenership. And I'm quite content to just keep doing this on a weekly level. I think people like to hear from us at least once a week. So let's wrap it up, and we will be back next week for another episode of Countercurrents Radio.